Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. Joining me to help manage the questions is Grace Barnett from the Compass office. Hello, Grace.
Hello.
These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in. A good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. This week on the Compass podcast, It's Bloody Complicated, we're looking at the creation of a caring society. To do that, we're joined by three super interesting people. Madeline Bunting, the journalist and writer, who's just published an amazing book called Labours of Love, The Crisis of Care. We're joined by Jo Littler, an academic and member of the Care Collective, who've just published another brilliant book called The Care Manifesto, The Politics of Independence. And finally, last but not least, we're joined by Alex Fox, the CEO of an amazing organisation called Shared Lives that brings carers and the cared for together. He's also the author of a book, A New Health and Care System, Escaping the Invisible Asylum. As ever, I'll ask our guests a few questions, and it's over to Compass members on the call to ask theirs. So, I've got three of you. We're going to take you in turn and then bring you all together. Madeline Bunting, first question that we always ask everyone is, where are you and how are you?
I'm at home and I'm fine. I've been enjoying the last day of the summer. That's what it feels like. Tomorrow the weather breaks. So beautiful, beautiful day today.
Good, good, good. Right, your book, it's called Labours of Love, and it obviously was a labour of love. It took you 5 years to compile, and you went out and did a proper job of talking to people, a real ethnographic study of care and carers. Tell us everything about the book, why you did it, what it means to you, where it's going, and what does it tell us?
Oh, loads and loads of questions there. So I think it starts with two different sort of drivers, if you like. One is that the coverage of care was, it seemed, about a crisis we couldn't solve. So there was this sort of relentless kind of repetitive cycle. So when I was a journalist, I felt, you know, one could be caught in a loop of writing a very similar sort of column or report sort of on a regular basis. And that was multiple forms of care seemed to be stuck in this kind of loop of really not being able to kind of grasp it, change it, reform it. And the problem was, it was not for lack of ideas. And Shared Lives is an example, as Alex will talk to us about, of kind of all sorts of possible alternatives. So the crisis was not about a lack of ideas. And I think that was my starting point, was really kind of trying to think, well, what is it that seems to cripple us in terms of innovating and in terms of really kind of managing to create a care system? And the other aspect of it was much, much more personal. It was about when I kind of looked back at decades of my life, I had a story about my career that people would ask me about, or I would say, but in fact, I would say just as much effort, energy, if not more, had gone into my caring roles that as it had done into my any kind of working life. And I just felt that there was a complete imbalance in terms of the public recognition, affirmation of what was absolutely the kind of meat and stuff of so many conversations with predominantly so many other women about how we manage deeply complex care relationships. So I wanted the book to tackle both care within an intimate context, but also care within a political context and within a context of sort of organisations and systems and the welfare state. So that was my starting point. So I think I felt, my hunch really, was that the root of the crisis was connected to what I'd also noticed in my own life, which was a profound, pervasive lack of interest into actually what care entails, what it actually involves. And And that led me into digging very, very deep into a very rich academic literature around the philosophy of care, the sociology of care, gender studies. And so, you know, like the writer that I am, I sort of romp over every single disciplinary boundary, magpie-like, pick up all the bits I like, totally unsystematic from an academic point of view, I'm afraid. What was really clear to me is that this thinking had to be accessible. We had to kind of find a way to talk about care and to describe the complexity and richness of the subject in a way that every reader could grasp. And alongside that kind of reading of the literature, I felt there was this huge silence, the actual people who care. What do they have to say about their work and how do they understand care? And that was where the real richness of the material seemed to me to sort of jump out at me, which was that time and time again, when I asked a care worker, for example, if I could talk to them about their work and what care meant to them, they would start by saying, oh, I don't have much to say. I haven't really got anything to tell you. And they'd be very embarrassed and quite awkward. And then gradually what unfolded was these amazing kind of testimonies of how important they believed their work was, how articulate they were about describing it, and how powerful. It was almost like this is a sort of subterranean theme that goes on underneath the surface where people passionately hold to these values and principles and yet find no wider public affirmation. So the care workers that I talked to were almost defensive. I was fascinated by this kind of position they had been thrown into by society of having to being required to be ashamed of their work. One woman described at the school gate that she felt embarrassed admitting she was a care worker. And the kind of revulsion as people step away from her almost. And yet how important she knew the work to be. And it seemed to me that kind of dissonance was really painful burden for this person, for this woman to carry. And I think that there are many, many others that are in a similar position as her. So that's why I spend such a large chunk of the book on interviewing and on that ethnographic approach of just listening to people. And I also wanted to look at the kind of the whole range of different forms of care, or at least sample them, because to be honest, there's so many, it's such an enormous empire is how I describe it. But, you know, I wanted to go to really high status jobs like GPs and doctors and talk to doctors. What is their understanding of care? Because here's a profession which has an enormous amount of education and qualification and a very sophisticated understanding of how to articulate their understanding of care. But even they felt beleaguered and under siege, so that so many aspects of the kind of values of care are under a sort of multiple assault, routinization, automation, bureaucratization, and a kind of loss of autonomy. And that's as true of GPs as it is of care workers. And so you know, that is a kind of one disturbing aspect, dimension of the crisis. One other aspect, if I have time to just briefly kind of describe.
You're fine.
One other way, is that okay, Neil?
Yeah. And can you then roll this into, so, you know, what did you learn I don't want to use the word recommendations, but both in terms of how we talk about it and how we feel about it, but also for institutional change as well. So, you know, what did you come out with in terms of answers to these profound problems?
Well, one other dimension of the crisis is that I think we've got three long-term trends coinciding. One is the need for care is increasing in specific places. It's, you know, there's a sort of care deficit at certain points in the life course. And one of those we're familiar with all of this. I mean, this is the thing, it's not new, but we're living for longer. And as Alex himself has also written, we're living with frailty for longer. So that on average, we will spend 6 years in and out of hospitals with often multiple long-term health conditions to manage. So that's one sort of area of increasing care. And another is the unresolved question, which all of my working life has dogged us all, which is childcare. You know, we have a system built on the cheap, deeply precarious, appallingly badly paid, and we have never ever really worked out how to provide a high quality childcare system. And so those long-term trends about the deficit of care are coinciding with what we've seen over the last 30 years, rising female employment and the withdrawal of the welfare state. So it's like there is a kind of yawning kind of vacuum as to where these caring roles are, where and how they're being fulfilled. You know, the historical context is that women were socialized to care. It was women's work. And as women have moved into the labor market, it's left gaps. And the welfare state has not been prepared to step in, which is, of course, what happened in Scandinavia to a much greater extent. And COVID has ripped right through that whole kind of jerry-built, botched care system on the cheap. So in terms of kind of where do we go from here? Well, that's, you know, kind of huge other question. And in my final chapter, I think a lot about that. I think that part of it is about a kind of awareness and a recognition. And I have a sort of lament, which is that, you know, the fraction of the energy that had gone into the Me Too movement went into understanding how women try and hold this kind of chaotic system together at the price of their own lives, the kind of stress of trying to still maintain their caring responsibilities while also being wage earners. And so I kind of think that there is a feminist battle here, which is hugely important to all of us. And if anything that comes out of COVID and out of the books that people are writing about care is that we begin to see some energy and real commitment going into what I think is a sort of historically long overdue evaluation of the central role of care. Care is as important to human beings as work is. And, you know, goodness knows how much prestige and status and all the rest of it goes to work. So it's a kind of paradigm shift that I most sincerely want, because I think it's the paradigm shift that can unlock the organisational, the institutional shifts, which would enable the innovators like Alex to step into bring into being the kinds of brilliant ideas that they've had.
Fantastic. And we'll bring you back in a bit and we'll talk about that process, about how to get to that paradigm shift. But now over to Joe and the Care Collective. Tell us about the Care Collective, the book, what it's about and what you're hoping to achieve with it. Thanks, Joe.
Okay, so the Care Manifesto, which is just out with Verso, is a short polemical book that I co-wrote with four other people. But they're all academics as well, from different disciplines. So together we come from philosophy, cultural studies, sociology, gender, media and business. And that they are Lynn Siegel, Andreas Chatzidakis, Jamie Hakim and Catherine Rottenberg. So we came together initially as a reading group, and we all had shared interests in what we increasingly came to understand was a crisis of care. So we were interested in how, for example, care was in crisis because it was something that had both been devalued over centuries because it had been associated with the feminine, both marginalised and devalued. And then at the same time, it, as Madeline has gestured towards, it's something that's been suffering from 40 years of neoliberal failure, you know, marketisation, deregulation, outsourcing. So we were kind of interested in how this, what we, like other people, have identified as the crisis of care, can be seen across multiple different dimensions of life. And we started out kind of identifying and critiquing why this was so. And then we decided that perhaps a more productive way of dealing with the issue would be to think about how you could solve this crisis on a number of different levels and scales. So we wrote a short book which kind of takes, it looks at different scales of life and works out from the very intimate relationships of care that we have with close family and friends or kinship groups, and looks through communities and the state and the economy to the world, and tries to really kind of sketch a broad sense of what it would look like to put care at the front and centre of life, what it would mean to really value care and to foreground that as our priority. So we kind of work through and we think about how you might pluralize the work of caring kinships. And we take a lot of examples from historical precedents. So and for the kinship section, for example, we think about the precedents that were set by ACT UP during the AIDS crisis and the kind of early mutual aid groups. And then in communities, we look at examples from municipal socialism, from the GLC, think about ways in which you might build cooperatives. And then in the state, we look at how you might get involved in more insourcing projects and how you might kind of pluralize care at a transnational level by regulating international financial institutions and promoting Green New Deals. So it's a kind of short but broad thought experiment on what it would mean to put care at the centre of life. And I think there are a lot of overlaps with both Madeline and Alex's work. But I think, also we tried to, one thing that came out of it is that we really felt that we needed to have a very capacious notion of care. You know, we needed to broaden our understanding of care as not just involving hands-on care, but as something which sustains and reproduces society, or what we kind of think of as universal care.
And we'll come back to this in the other questions, Jo, but in particular, because, you know, you're such a kind of political actor and thinker, I mean, you know, the problem with, I mean, good care happens in kind of bubbles despite the system. And I mean, going back to Madeline's point, we need a paradigm shift, don't we? I mean, this is a big question, and it isn't just about care, but now care is at the forefront of that conversation, just in a way that climate has been. I mean, how do we break through, and how does care help us break through? Is it helping us break through and change the paradigm and the tone and the nature of the society we operate in?
It's giving us that potential, isn't it? It gives us that possibility, but it really depends on what we do with it. So there's a very right-wing response to care, which is to commodify it, which is to offer kind of care-washing narratives like corporations do. Buy this product and you will care, get involved in neurotic self-care products completely, you know, all the time. And there's a very kind of individualized solution to that. But I think that's why we wanted to really emphasize the interdependent nature of care. And you think about how, if you break, care offers you the possibility to think about our interdependence and to really foreground the issue of dependency. Because we've been sold over the past few decades this idea that we need, above all, to be autonomous individuals who are completely self-reliant, who are entrepreneurial, who aren't dependent. And what I think care allows us to do is to rethink that notion of dependency. You know, we have to kind of depathologize dependency. We have to kind of break it away from that stigma and you know, think about how we are all dependent all the time, you know, that we can't get away from that. And think about how the kind of the relationship between agency and dependency needs to be foregrounded and understood.
And that's deep and cultural. You say that there's a right-wing version of care. There is also a traditional left-wing version of care, which is essentially the one where you create a national care service, as if, I mean, and I worry quite deeply about that, you know, as if it's 1948 and you can do what we did to the, you know, normal health service and create a kind of national monolith. Does that have a role to play? Is that part of the answer?
I think there's a lot of really good policy recommendations in the document for a national care service in the 2017 manifesto. And I think, I mean, what it needs to be broadened out, it needs to be deepened. And also some of the work that you've done at Compass, Neil, around, say, co-production, and Hilary Cottam's work on radical help. You could think about how a national care service, it sounds problematic because it sounds a bit patriarchal and top down, doesn't it? So we need to think about how we can introduce kind of more responsive models of care, which involve co-production, but which do that in a socialized way and don't let corporations in through the back door.
And then just, I mean, sometimes when I kind of go to conferences abroad and meet some of my kind of Scandinavian kind of, you know, comrades, sometimes I wonder, do they ever see their kids? I mean, the state is so good at providing services, wraparound school staff. They don't have to worry about care because it's so, and I kind of sometimes think that, you know, the outsourcing of the socialisation of your kids to strangers, is that necessarily a good thing? And is that what we're after?
Well, we need childcare options, but I think that's where it maps into the campaigns for a four-day week. So we need to reduce the overwork culture, as Madeline's also written about in the past, and you know, have time to care. We're being positioned in a culture where we don't have enough time to care. It's more difficult for us to care, and it's more difficult for us to be cared for.
So let's go over to Alex. But that point that you can't just do a caring society in the bubble of a kind of neoliberal capitalist system, because you're doing it despite the system all the time. And I'm just interested in the role of care, of kind of breaking out of the bubble. Alex, over to you. So you're a writer about this stuff, but also you're a kind of deep practitioner of this stuff. And what you've done, which is amazing, is to take an experiment and an idea and scale it to a national level. And I'm in awe of what you do, and in awe of people like my amazing sisters, Sharon and Sarah, that are part of your shared life scheme that offer respite care to people. So tell us about what you do, what your hopes are, and maybe, you know, what are some of the problems that you face in the work that, you know, you're trying to develop your organisation.
Yeah, no, it's predates me by many decades. I've been involved in the world of shared lives and home share for about a decade now. But these models are 40 years old and have been quietly working away in the background without people realising they're there. So we are a network across the UK of people and organisations who are all forming supportive shared households. So there are 10,000 shared life carers now right around the UK. They've all been through a really rigorous approval process, which often takes several months, and then they're matched with an adult who needs support. So if you're somebody with a learning disability or a mental health problem or dementia or another significant support need, rather than going to a day centre, you would go and visit your chosen shared life carer. Or rather than moving into a care home, you'd move in with your shared life carer and live as part of the carer's household or family. And some people have lived like that for 40 years and say they want to live like that forever. For others, it's more of a stepping stone to getting their own place. So I often talk about Meg, who works with us now, improving the model and talking about her experience of shared lives as her escape route out of a series of long stays in mental health hospitals. She now lives in her own place, but her stepping stone was being matched with Hayley, who's a shared life carer, who provided her with all of the practical and emotional support she needed to learn for the first time really how to live as a young adult in the community. But then also to build the community, because we talk a lot in social care about community care, but we don't often really know what we mean by community. We often think it means a building that looks a bit like a house and that's on an ordinary street, whereas of course community is, it's our relationships and our connections with the people around us. And shared lives is particularly good at supporting people who might need really significant personal and sometimes medical care, but they also need a bed and somewhere to stay. And they need friends. And of course, that's all of us. We need somewhere to feel where we belong. And actually, as Joe was saying, somewhere to feel dependent, that it's okay to be dependent. So I wrote the book to try and sort of chart my kind of journey and my culture shock from starting off my career working as a care assistant in residential care, where I remember learning all about boundaries and risk and professionalism and all sorts of things like that. And then quite sort of having worked in around the care sector for a long time, coming across this whole group of people that I didn't realise existed, who talked a lot more about love and fun and doing the sorts of things that we all take for granted, but doing that within the context of a regulated care service. And that all sounded really risky, but also sort of tantalizingly like what good life sounds like to me. It's a model that's managed to carve out a space in that overlaps two very different worlds. So in the book, I suggest that The issues that the Joe and Madeline have been talking about, I would trace them right back to the formation of our public services and our charities when we separated people into two groups. There are citizens who can live as they wish in their community, but often can't get the help that they need. And then there are people we've regarded through the ages as somehow wards of the state or patients or often the inmates of asylums. And that's what I call the book Escaping the Invisible Asylum, because we used to separate people out in a very physical way. And now the asylums have been demolished or turned into luxury flats. We like to think that now we have community services. And actually, my realization as I got to know this community of people who were thinking very differently was that the culture of the asylum is much more deeply embedded and encoded into all of our public service systems than we like to imagine. And Shared Lives and Home Share, which is the other model we support, which matches older, isolated older people with younger people who are looking for somewhere affordable to live, again, brings people together once they feel they've got a good match with each other to support each other. They were both ways of challenging that whole idea of what a service is and where it exists. And it allows people to form a very different kind of relationship. And I came to the conclusion that actually this wasn't just a model or a couple of models which are still relatively small, although growing, and Shared Life certainly now has national scale. It was perhaps a glimpse of what our public services could look like if we thought about them differently. And perhaps we could all learn lessons about how you create those kind of roles, which are much more autonomous and involve a much greater degree of trust, how you recruit to them, how you make them safe, but then how you start to value care in a very different way through having seen what people can achieve together. And I'm constantly hearing about people that have achieved things that they weren't expected to. And through COVID, as we've seen people trying to cope with all of the pressures of that, we've still also seen just a constant stream of people achieving things, learning new skills, surviving together and working as a household together, not being isolated or having to feel like they're living within a system that's become in some cases riskier and riskier.
So you've met with a lot of success through the organization. I mean, how big could the concept of Shared Lives be to fill the kind of care vacuum, and what would it need to accelerate it way beyond its current capacity, Alex? I mean, is it scalable to a much, much bigger extent?
So we're often growing by sort of a few hundred people a year in England, where the stats are sort of where we have the clearest data and also probably the strongest growth, although the other nations are catching up. So if every area caught up with the best, we'd more than double the size of the sector. And there are now areas like Greater Manchester and also the Northeast where they've taken a much more ambitious approach. In the book, that's one of the things I was really interested in. What keeps the things that we all broadly agree are the right approaches that intuitively feel human, but also in the case of Shared Lives, CQC, the inspectors say it's the best form of care year after year. And we know it's about £30,000 a year cheaper for people with learning disabilities. So it does the things that innovations are supposed to do in order to scale, and it's still not as big as we'd like it to be. So I was interested in the way, and I came to the conclusion that collectively we all collaborate in keeping these models small. So for instance, I looked at the role of research, and for me, there is a kind of academic public service complex that sucks up all of the big research budgets and time and attention into the big ticket items within the care system. Because actually, we need to know whether our hospitals are working to the best of their possible ability, because they cost us billions of pounds each year. Excuse me. But the trouble with that is that then there's a sort of a black hole effect where all of the resources and attention gets into knowing the minutiae of the hospital at a time when we all agree what we really want is to get people out of hospitals and into into their ordinary homes. And I think the same is true of the way we approach risk. We focus much more narrowly onto risks which keep us locked into roles, which ironically then create the very risks that we're concerned about. And we see all of the big abuse scandals happening in the highest cost and most institutional settings. So I think we're all unwittingly collaborating in what we tend to define as the system. And we think there is a system out there somewhere that if only we could all escape from it, we'd be able to do things very differently. But actually, if you look at the model of shared lives, it just creates enough space for people to be human with each other, and they are able to get on with it. So I think, ironically, one of the things we need to do to scale models like Shared Lives up is to learn how to scale things down. So I take a slightly different view to perhaps Joe's on the kind of the national care system question. I think we need clear national entitlements, but for me the solution is in small, locally and often individually owned community, certainly kind of neighborhood owned care services. I'd go for a mutual and co-op future for social care, to get away from this idea that it's got to be either a return to the sort of the big state model, or we've got to kind of outsource and let the hedge funds kind of run riot through a care system that's already collapsing.
And Alex, and maybe, you know, and Joe and Madeline could come into this as we begin to open this out. And if you haven't put any questions in the chat thing yet, please do when it's your turn. Are there other countries, Alex, that do it a lot better than us, that you've seen have that right kind of mix and right kind of cultural approach?
So this, obviously the Scandinavian countries organise and fund their care systems really well, but in my small contact with them, I have sort of felt that there is a paternalism which they perhaps get away with because things are really well resourced, but where if the resources start to dip, you're left with the paternalism, and you could see that sort of, you know, argue that's what's happened in the UK as the resources have got more and more stretched. We've still got the legacy of a kind of industrialized and quite paternalistic model of care, just without the resources. The shared lives there are a number of European countries do it a little bit around mental health. Italy, for instance, has a history of small amounts of shared lives. There are other models like L'Arche, which share some similarities in values. The only other country that does it in any scale is British Columbia and Canada. About half their learning disability living support is a model which confusingly they call home share, but is what we would describe as shared lives. But that's within a relatively small population. Home share is a global movement that's much bigger in a whole range of nations than it is in the UK. We're really lagging behind on home share.
Joe and then Madeline, is there any kind of global experience that you've come across which kind of shines a light on the future?
I've got one suggestion. Sorry, Joe, do you want to go
no,
first? I was looking at one aspect of care that I looked at was care of the dying. And this is often where, you know, people who've had very little experience of hands-on care are suddenly catapulted into a situation where they have to be the prime carer. And it can be a very, very frightening, disorientating experience. Say if you're looking after a partner who's dying or whatever, you suddenly have to take on a lot of medical knowledge, etc. And in Kerala, they've developed a really fascinating model called compassionate communities, which has been hugely successful. You know, thousands and thousands of volunteers trained to go into homes to support the person who's dying, support all those who are supporting the dying person, because they understand death as a very social process. It's not just about one individual, it's about a whole network, and the relatives need support just as much, almost as much, as the person who's dying. And it's been such a sort of inspirational model that it's been picked up in many, many countries across the world. And there is several projects in the UK called Compassionate Communities, often run out of hospices. So, you know, that I think it's got a similar sort of ethos to what Alex is describing. It's small scale, it's very local, it's very neighbourhood based. I think it's a really moving thing, having kind of been involved in some of their meetings and met their volunteers. you know, the kind of, it's human to human meeting at a point of acute vulnerability, and it can be profoundly enriching for both parties.
Do you have anything in particular for you on kind of comparative stuff?
I think that I wouldn't necessarily endorse a solely nationalist model. So I think we talk in the manifesto about how a mixed economy is useful, but as long as it's a mixed anti-capitalist economy. So I think it's important that we insist that no one can profit from other people's pain. And there are examples, like there's an organisation called Bertzog in the Netherlands, which is a co-op, which has been really very successful. And there's also care homes in British Columbia, in Canada, that have been brought back into the public sector. So there's different models, I think, that we can learn from globally to create that kind of mixed anti-capitalist economy of care.
Bertzog is being run in the UK by our friend Brendan Martin, and maybe we'll get Brendan on to talk about that at some stage. So, I mean, I think this is a fascinating sector. It's fascinating because it brings out the human in us, and whatever, whether it's outsourced or the big state or whatever, you never crush the kind of human spirit in the way that Madeline's talked about that. And you know, COVID has accelerated that process. You know, we are interdependent, we are dependent, we need each other. That's why it's brilliant. The other reason it's brilliant is that because I've never seen a sector that has so much kind of innovative practice of people experimenting with different things and trying different things. But I see this kind of struggle to be human and struggle to innovate and come up with answers that the bureaucratic state and the free market, you know, won't provide. And yet it doesn't ever get to scale. It doesn't ever get to the paradigm shift. I mean, is that a purely political problem, that our kind of political parties are locked into either a market-driven system or a bureaucratic state system, and don't know how to let go? Or are there councils in particular that people are working with? Maybe Alex, that's a good, you know, good one to you, who are operating in that kind of lighter touch, creating the framework, creating the guidelines, but then providing resources and then getting out of the way and letting people get on with it. Is this essentially a political problem? Madeline, are you making notes? Have you got any thoughts?
I thought Alex was going to answer this.
Well, let's go to the council one first, maybe, Alex. Or what's your experience of governments nationally as well?
So the political sort of bit, obviously, partly that is how much money are you willing to put into this? And at the moment, we don't put enough money into social care, full stop, and we won't ever get beyond that until we do. The question, once you've done that, is then what do you do? Because it would be possible to put a really large amount into shoring up the current system and still have significant failure. And Philippa Russell, who chaired the carers, Standing Commission on Carers, always says that it reminds us that it was often at the times of the greatest wealth when we created the institutions and the asylums. And actually, obviously, 1948 was not a time of great wealth, and we managed to create the NHS. And I think that's very true. So it's not just about money. I would say it is partly about control. But I think both left and right have gone down the wrong alleys on that, seeking control from the market, which doesn't work, or control from the state, which doesn't work. I'd come back to this idea that we need a fundamental reimagining of the core role at the heart of our public services, to get away from the idea that we should offer people a whole series of brief professional client transactions as they go through these, as Madeline says, these very long, complex care journeys. That's never been great, and it really doesn't work now. What we're looking for generally are a smaller number of chosen, more equal and deeper relationships. Shared lives and at home share give you a kind of a more extreme version of what that can look like, which will work for lots of people, it doesn't work for everyone. But actually, we could, I think, organise all of our longer-term public services. And I think the self-organising teams model that Bertzog uses is perhaps one of the keys to that, because that enables that autonomy to happen and that organisation to happen at the community team level. And the infrastructure behind it is incredibly light touch. I think their central office has sort of 40 or 50 people in it, and they support about 60,000 people with significant dementia.
Yeah, hugely productive and efficient, but very local, close, and you know, flexible and agile. Anything on the politics of this, Joe? Kind of, you know, why is this all this pent up potential? You know, why can't it be unleashed and unlocked?
Well, you're right that it's intimately connected, and all the examples that Alex has given that are more progressive are also examples that kind of aid democratisation, aren't they? So they're very intertwined. And you might think about how you mentioned COVID. You know, England has a contracted out privatised test and trace system, doesn't it? Unlike Scotland and Wales. So we use Serco. We're not using local councils in the same way that Scotland and Wales are. So you can think about that. You could also think about, yeah, people just have to kind of grasp at the opportunities, don't they? So we might also connect this to the movements for radical municipalism, re-municipalism, the Preston model, where people are being encouraged locally to set up worker cooperatives. They're all interconnected, I think, profoundly, the question of democracy and empowerment and capacity.
So Neil, I think the kind of, you know, to go back to the question that you put to all of us about, you know, is this a problem about politics? I would say it's sort of deeper and underlying that there's a kind of a set of cultural issues here, which mean that the electorate don't push it up the agenda as much as it needs to, that politicians feel they can get away with fudging or endlessly postponing solutions. So to my mind, this is about a set of interconnected issues, and Joe mentioned one, which is a sort of a set of cultural problems that we have around dependence, that is still something that carries stigma, around an undervaluing, lack of valuing of old age. You know, one sociologist, you know, the foremost sociologist of aging, just concluded in his book that age has had no value in much of Western culture, but particularly British culture, in the way that it has, for example, in Asia. So, you know, we don't value elderly people, therefore we don't fund their care properly. So the cultural attitudes around dependence, around the elderly, and also around the idea that care has always been largely unpaid. Most care has happened within the context of the house and the family, and it has not been paid for. So it's never been kind of understood as something that does require pay and proper work conditions. The idea that a carer must go the extra mile out of the goodness of their heart is still entrenched in the care system. So this idea that care, to be really genuine, has to be free, dogs us all the time. So you get, you know, these private sector companies who boast of their care workers putting it, you know, going the extra mile, and you think, well, who are they subsidizing? So I feel there's a kind of exploitative process of that historical characteristic. So, you know, it's those, I think, those cultural contradictions have crippled the political will to really engage with this issue.
Hello, this is Grace from the Compass office, interrupting for a moment.
I'm lucky enough to come from a large and politically diverse family. We really did have the full political spectrum represented over Christmas dinner, but in spite of our differences, we still actually like each other. I've always known, because of this, that politics should be more about listening and learning from the people we disagree with than shouting at them and fighting with them. And of course, I've definitely known for a long time that it really is bloody complicated. So I was so happy that when one day I discovered Compass, quite by accident, through their brilliant work on the Progressive Alliance in the 2017 general election. Since then, it's been absolute pleasure to once again be part of a political family where talking to people in different political parties, admitting that you alone don't have all the answers, is not just okay, but actively encouraged. So if you'd like to find out more about Compass, you can visit compassonline.org.uk.
And now back to the conversation.
Grace, over to you. Do you want to bring some other voices into some questions and some points from the members? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Lots of really interesting
questions and comments coming in. I'm going to bring in this order, just to give you some warning, Rebecca Warren, Sue Goss, and then Barbara Cotman.
Yeah, okay. Well, my question had two parts. It was about what you might call traditional care homes. My grandfather, who lived to me nearly 90, he had to go into a care home for the last few months of his life because he had severe dementia and could no longer live alone. And when I visited, I thought it was a terrifying place. What I was thinking is, my first question is, do care homes like that still have a place in society? And things have changed. They now look like death traps. I mean, I'm now thinking, is there any way I can prevent either of my parents from having to go into a care home like that? There's this completely separate question is, given that some people do get dementia, they may have no people look to care for them. How should care homes be paid for? Because at the moment, it does seem like a lottery. If you have to go into a care home, you may well end up losing your life savings.
Thank you, Rebecca. Okay, Sue.
Hi. I mean, I'm very excited by what Alex and Madeline have been saying, because they sound like exactly what my work has always told me about health and social care. One of the things that I was reading one of the evaluations of the Birdsong experiments in the east of England, and it was suggesting that part of the problem here in the UK is the level of over-specialisation and over-regulation and over-control we've got in both health and social care systems. So that, for example, nurses are now so specialised, they don't like doing the Birdsong, like, generic look, you know, whatever it is the person needs, because they're so used to doing their specialist thing and handing it over. And social workers are increasingly trained to do assessment, but no longer really experienced in the sort of general support that, for example, the Life Project in Swindon experimented with. So some of this, I think, is, yes, there's a lot wrong with the regulatory system, and we need to perhaps, I'd like to hear a bit more about how people feel about what we've done in terms of regulating for risk, because that also makes it harder to do creative supportive things. But it may also be that we have trained professions to behave in certain ways which actually make it very hard for them to form relationships and to do loving. So I guess the question is, what might we need to do about the nature of a profession and the way we train people in the caring professions to change mindsets?
Thanks, Sue. And last question, quickly, one from Barbara.
My question follows on, I think, very much from Sue. And it has to do with our difficulties as a society, I suppose, about on the one hand needing and wanting to there to be care at a human level for our nearest and dearest, and on the other hand having somehow become more and more encouraged to think that we will get the best if we have regulation and potential recourse to litigation. So the tension between the statutory responsibilities that professionals are holding, obviously social workers in childcare are a case in point, I suppose, are very much in tension with all of the absolutely commendable and indeed necessary political changes that have been being discussed. And so I'm thinking about Hilary Cottam's work and the way in which, as I recall, many of her those projects that founded were those where the professionals around the individuals concerned really couldn't manage that tension and therefore couldn't link in and cooperate and support the projects in question. Where do we have to begin? Do we need to try and make something shift at that sort of what you might call the regulatory, litigatory end? Otherwise, I think we're asking a lot of a system if we want both.
Thanks, Barbara. Any of the panel want to pick out any of those comments?
Well, I guess the question, who should pay for elderly care, I think it should be paid for by the state. And the the position of care homes, you know, the COVID crisis has just illustrated the disregard in which care homes are kept, and the you know, the problems of the structure and how they're organised and run in terms of the way in which tasks have become very segmented and tailorised as well. In particular, you know, we could think about how social care has been something which has been, you know, people encouraged in training not to think about the whole person. They're encouraged to think about atomized tasks in very short blocks of time, as, you know, Ken Loach's film Sorry to Bother You dramatizes. So all these questions are interconnected. I think I should leave it to Alex to say more about the minutiae of how it's run.
Do you want to say something, Alex?
I'm after you, Madeline.
Okay. Well, I think both Sue and Barbara's points are really, really interesting. And, you know, Alex, I think, mentioned trust. What was striking was when I did some work in Denmark amongst pedagogues, which is this sort of social pedagogy, is this fantastic discipline of understanding human beings as full of potential. And the role of a social pedagogue is to support that potential at whatever point in the life course. So you do a 3-year degree, typically in Denmark, to become a social pedagogue, and then you can work with children or the elderly or with disability. And it was very interesting because I was interviewing a bunch of these students, and they were describing their degree, which was full of art, music, performance, creativity. And they'd gone for a secondment to Portsmouth University, I think, for a couple of months. So I asked, and they were describing to me the difference between the UK system and the Danish system. And it was sort of chalk and cheese. So they said, if you're training to be a social worker in the UK, it's about risk and it's about regulation. If you're training to be a social worker in Denmark, it's about art school and drama, about developing your own human potential and creativity. It's something has gone sort of awry in our culture. The way we scapegoat social workers, I think, is excruciatingly painful. And I think there's another separate point, because there's a really complex area here that Sue and Barbara, I think, would completely be able to speak to. But nurses, this problem about over-specialisation has dogged nursing for a very long time. So many people would be familiar with the work of Isabel Menzies, the anthropologist, who just did this very, very influential paper in the 1960s about how nurses could not emotionally engage with their patients. And the way their work was organised was to prevent that. Nurses and nursing is inherently an anxious-making profession. They're dealing with human vulnerability. And the defence mechanisms that have been developed within the discipline, now they tried to dismantle some of that following Menzies to put more of an emphasis on relationship, but it continues to be a tension within nursing. To what extent do you encourage relationship? To what extent does the nurse manage to sort of distance themselves from the patient and the suffering of the patient? And I talked to a lot of nurses with very different perspectives on this. A director of nursing told me she feared that the trend in nursing had all been to retreat behind the screen, and that most of the hands-on nursing is now done by nursing assistants who have a fraction of the training. So lots more to be said on that, but I think it's an incredibly rich subject.
I'd like to continue in that vein, and sort of thinking about those points that Sue and Barbara were raising around risk. And so we often talk in public service sector about risk-averse organisations, organisations which I think sort of, as Madeline describes, where people have been wrapped up in process designed to minimise risk. I always think that idea of organisations or people being risk-averse is a misnomer, and actually they're risk-selective. Because they're very focused on the risks which could affect the professional or the organisation, things you can get sued for. And often those organisations which are most risk averse are also most blasé about the risks which matter most to people. So they tend to be the services where people are able to be the least human in their roles. And so where the risks of indignity and loneliness and isolation and not being able, I'm thinking here particularly say about some of the services for people with learning disabilities, that those that are most medicalized and formal and often eye-wateringly expensive are the ones where the risks of being isolated and kept safe from life somehow, as well as then that can lead into some pretty dark places in terms of abuse, are the highest. And so there is risk in any human interaction. You know, we have safeguarding incidents within the shared life sector, but they, according to all of the data that the inspector collects and so on, they're much fewer and further between than in all of the other social care sectors. And I think that's because the roles that are created are different, the relationship expectations are different. And all of the things which really sort of struck me and sort of shocked me slightly when I came into this sector, heard people talking about, well, he's just part of the family and we love him, and all of those things that you didn't talk about in public services, and that roles, as Madeline was describing, are often set up to prevent, were at the heart of this model, which actually then was creating more safety. And one of the reasons it was doing that was because people were more visible in their community. They weren't separated off into service land. They had relationships. The people working with them had a role, like the social pedagogy role, to actually help people build their relationships and their presence in the community. And I think the movement towards asset-based approaches in the kind of US jargon, which is taking hold, and strengths-based approaches, does hold out some promise for that. The idea that we should stop focusing exclusively on what people's risks and needs and problems are and start looking for people's capacity and potential. And so that I think suggests an answer to this specialization question. We do need specialist people where there is a very specific specialist need, but we also need people who can be generalists, and who they're generous because they're led by the people they work with. And I'd point to the Australian local area coordination model, which is now being developed in the UK, where local area coordinators have one foot in the state and one foot in the community. They're state funded, but they're able to work in a much more voluntary sector ethos. And their role is to get to know you, to find out what good life looks like to you and how you want to get there, and then to put in the minimum amount of help really that's needed. In other words, services are there if you need them, but actually if that's a journey you can go on with the people around you, then that's the most desirable way of doing that. I think that sort of asset-based approach can sort of offers out a different kind of support relationship.
I was going to try and get some more in, Grace, but I think we're probably running out of time a bit, just to get a final round and not run past 10 past at the very latest. So I just wanted to come back to thank you for those great questions. So there's kind of two last bits from me, really, and if we could go around and get responses, really. I mean, the first one is a sort of very compass point about, you know, for this thing to reach scale, for different systems to actually kind of get anywhere and change the paradigm, which is cultural, institutional, you know, deep, philosophical. There's something about the care sector having to get more political itself, and I don't mean backing one party or another. I do mean actively lobbying and working for a different system, because unless you do that, as I say, you're always going to be running up the down escalator and doing your best despite the system and not because of it. And is there any recognition of the care sector needing to take a more political role? And then finally, if you know, what would be the elements the three of you would see that would need to be put in place for a paradigm shift? I'm only talking in just general sense, but a kind of, you know, how much state and what state and how much civil society, and, you know, does that kind of broad model exist anywhere, or what comment have you got on that? So let's go around again, maybe in that same order, so that people have had a bit of a rest. Joe, then Madeline, then Alex.
Well, there's some good examples, aren't there, of what should happen in the care sector. The Labour MP, Nadia Whittam, whistleblowing the lack of PPE in the care home that she worked in. So So yeah, obviously that's crucial, and as is people who don't work in the care sector supporting those sectors, because the impact of them and their relationship to the wider society is broad and deep. So, you know, we need, as a lot of people said, we need not just to clap for nurses, we need to make sure they're paid better. So that's all pretty crucial. I think in terms of thinking about the relationship between the state and the private sector and the family, I think we need to make sure that, you know, we don't kind of enter a new phase in which people end up taking the slack for all the problems of neoliberalism and its gaps and its failures. And also, you know, unlike perhaps Keir Starmer today, we need to move beyond fetishizing the family. You know, COVID shown us how wider kinship groups are around us and are possible, and the mutual aid groups have been really heartening. So I think we need to, you know, think of inventive and multiple ways in which we can work to kind of push the private sector out of care as much as possible, you know, further than we think is possible now. You know, think about how we can roll back neoliberalism, perhaps, instead of rolling back the welfare state, and, you know, use all these different innovative small-scale projects, and as well as the large-scale unionisation and the political agitation, to work together to move towards, you know, bringing together socialised provision of care, which is not ghettoised, which is not just women's work, which is not just the work of migrant labour, but which is valued and a central part of a good functioning society.
Thanks, Jo. Madeline, last words?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I set myself in terms of the task in the book is this question of reimagining the paradigm shift, you know, and for me that seems to be based on a deeper, better understanding of the history, the role that inspirational individuals have had in breaking through, attracting public attention. I mean, something like Barbara Robb in 1964, Sans Everything, she absolutely exploded the issue of what was known as the back wards. The care of the elderly was left unaddressed in 1948, and the conditions of many geriatric wards in the 50s and 60s were so shocking that the politicians themselves would retreat from visits, horrified by what was going on. So this care deficit has been with us a long time, and to understand the theory of change, which is what you're asking me, I do think that an individual with passion and real drive can push things in a dramatic way. Now, Barbara Robb didn't solve it, but she definitely mobilised a huge turnaround in thinking that this was not good enough and the quality of care for the elderly had to change, and tragically then died very shortly afterwards. So her career was very kind of truncated. So this is an area where, you know, I don't want to kind of fall into that awful sort of polar opposites between with the role of the individual and the role of society. You know, these things inevitably both have roles and play in different ways. But inspiration is really important in this. It's really important. You are inspired to care by witnessing or experiencing good care yourself. And that, again and again, was what nurses said to me. So you create cultures of care within organisations which are driven by inspiration. And I think that that is absolutely vital. I really liked in Jo's book the way in which they point out the care collective, how there are very diverse, different forms of kinship emerging from people who don't want to fit the traditional family model. And I think that's really, really exciting and heartening. The nature of commitment to another human being to support them through vulnerability, it's tough. It's really tough. So this is you know, when friends do it for each other, or you know, those different forms of kinship that Jo has already referred to in terms of AIDS, the gay community, for example. I think it's a reminder that the instinct to care is innate. And I profoundly believe that. And that is the source of my optimism, that as human beings, we have various kind of foundational drivers. And one of them is to care. And it is one of the most meaningful and fulfilling experiences of a human life.
Let's build a world around that. Over to you, Alex.
Yeah, so one way of looking at home share and shared lives and models like them is they put just enough structure around selecting the right people and connecting them with each other to create that much broader range of kinship and family and household relationships that Joe written about, Adeline was just describing. And the trick is to be able to put enough of that structure in to make it safe and affordable. And so, you know, these are paid roles in terms of shared life carers. To come back to the discussion earlier about should care be free, I think one of the interesting things Shared Lives does is it allows people to be paid in a way that decouples the payment from the love that they're able to show to somebody who's chosen to be in their lives and they've chosen to be in their lives. So yeah, I mean, clearly this is, you know, one area that amongst all others where that the personal is political, you know, your political kind of question. The two things that we are most reluctant to talk about in public service reform are love and power. And they're intricately intertwined throughout any all of these issues. And we need to find a way of talking about both of them. And I think if you divorce the politics from the issues around love, then you're not really talking about care anymore. You are talking about services. So you need to be able to do both. I can't remember the other question, but my answer to it, because I made some notes, was around whole system change. So we can't poodle about the edges, and we can't carry on piloting things that we already know work with no real plan for resource transfer. We have to be really ambitious. And so we won't get any of these models that we've all been talking about unless we get all of them. And that requires this fundamental system change at both a local and a national level, which starts with setting ourselves a different goal for public services, which is much more based around well-being and resilience than it is around the very fractured and often sort of narrow medicalized goals we have at the moment.
Brilliant. And what the three of you have done and the questions have inspired me to think about, you know, what Compass can do to work on the politics of changing care and that whole systems approach, because, you know, that's where we may be able to add something. So thank you very, very much, Madeline, Joe and Alex and our members for contributing to another great conversation. Next week, we'll be joined by Ed Miliband, Labour's Shadow Business Secretary and former party leader. Until then, thanks everyone, but especially Madeline, Joe and Alex. Keep safe and keep well. Keep hopeful and both take and give as much care as you can. Thanks everyone. Good night. So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore Compass, or Compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.